So today we're going to talk about Apache Spark on the Azure HD Insight. So I'm Matthew Winter. I'm a member of the Global Black Belt team. I concentrate on big data and advanced analytics. My colleague Dan Schwa is from Hortonworks. He's our local Spark expert.
Thank you, Matthew. It's Ned, not Dan.
Oh,
you always forget. Anyway,
that's his colleague. So
my name is Ned. I work at Hortonworks. I specialize in Spark. For the last 7 months or almost a year as well, we've been running meetups around the country. Who's from Sydney? Raise your hand. Melbourne. Great. Brisbane. Awesome. So unfortunately, not for Brisbane, but for Sydney and Melbourne, we do have meetups that have been running for the last year, mainly for Spark. Brisbane is coming, I promise. So hopefully we're going to have the next meetup in Brisbane somewhere in the next 2 to 3 months. And we will hopefully launch in a Spark meetup and see how we go. Yeah. Back to you, Matthew.
Okay. And this is really just to show how close Microsoft and Hortonworks really are. So HD Insight itself is the Microsoft Hadoop distribution, but it's entirely based off of the Hortonworks data platform. And you'd have seen recently in the various different announcements, we've been making a lot of progress in migrating HD Insight to Linux. That went GA recently with the Hadoop, and certainly for Spark, which is currently in public preview, we have a Linux version that's actually in private preview today. And moving forward, we'd actually recommend all our customers using HD Insight to use the Linux version. And the reason for that, it might quite surprise you coming from Microsoft, but the main reason for that is we're going to be shortening the actual release cycle, and the way we can achieve that is to actually follow the Hortonworks data platform releases, which is, of course, on Linux. And so the idea being is that within 90 days of each release, we'll actually have that out in at least a public preview or release on HD Insight as well. So just quickly, how many in the audience is actually using HD Insight today? I got one hand. Anyone using Spark? Is it on-prem or in the cloud?
Cloud.
Amazon or Microsoft? Okay. We'll see if we can persuade you to move that across to Azure. So essentially, to create a Spark instance, it really is as simple as what this slide shows. It is, you go to the actual, either the management portal or the actual new preview portal, and you're able to spin up a Spark instance. Minimum size at the moment is 4 data nodes. And as I said, you can spin that up in Windows. It's Spark 1.2.1 today. And the Linux version is actually a slightly newer release of Spark. Now, the other thing, benefit of actually using the Azure version of Spark, or at least the instance of Spark, is the fact that it actually is fully integrated with the rest of the Azure ecosystem. And so we see an example here. A lot of people use Spark for the streaming capabilities, and you can integrate that directly into things like Event Hub. So if you wanted to use some of the stream analytics in combination with the Spark streaming, you can actually do that via the use of the Azure Event Hub. And in addition to that, visualization, yes, there's true open source methods of doing visualizations, and I know that Ned is actually going to show you some examples of that later, but you can integrate Power BI as well and actually use Power BI for the visualizations. And not forgetting, there's actually other tools that we also support as well within the ecosystem today. So we have Tableau, ClickView, and the SAP Lumia solution available today. I'm going to now hand over to Ned, who's going to discuss Spark for you.
Great. Thank you, Matthew. So Spark, it was a long journey. Every meetup, we come out in front of the public and we start talking about what's happening in every new update. I remember starting from Spark 1.2, now we're at 1.5. I'll give you a little bit on the updates, what happened between 1.2 and 1.5. But let's first, because I don't think a lot of people here have worked on Spark or heard about. How many of you heard about Spark at least before? Great, so at least you know what Spark is, and we'll take it from there. So the most important part for me to understand that Spark is not just another tool in the ecosystem that in the Hadoop ecosystem that we usually talk about. So if you're familiar with Hadoop started very back in days with MapReduce, and it was a great use case for the batchy workloads at that time. Until people like HortonWorks, for example, came up with new processing systems like Tez, for example, that works with Hive and do better stuff than just MapReduce. But when Spark came in as a complete platform that sits on top of Hadoop, for example. And when we say about a platform, we're talking about a platform where you can actually do SQL. So there's a Spark SQL. The other part of the platform would be Spark Streaming. So if you want to just do the streaming part, you can do that with Spark Streaming. The machine learning part of Spark, that is Spark ML and GraphX, and of course Spark R, and that was one of the biggest news that happened in 1.4, that R was introduced into Spark. And that changed a lot of the game as well. Now, what is common between all of those is actually they're all using the Spark core engine underneath that. So that means anything or any component of those using any sort of data set, that data set is stored here at the core engine in memory. And that means if you're trying to do something with the data from SQL, you're jumping directly to memory to do that. And if you're streaming the data even before that, you're doing the same thing on the memory. So once the data set in memory once, you can access it from any of those. And that's the beauty of it. So the more components you use in the platform, the better utilization you get out of the memory because your data set is already there in the memory and you can utilize it. Now, how does it run? So because Spark is a platform, Spark requires a resource manager to run on top of. And when we say resource managers, we talk about clusters. We talk about you have a worker node and you have a master node. The master node assigning workloads to the worker nodes, and somebody have to coordinate how that happened and how you're going to get the result back. And this is when the resource managers comes in play. So if you're familiar with Yarn, HortonWorks brought Yarn to the market around 4 years ago now. And before that, there was no resource manager for Hadoop. So HortonWorks have done a great job in bringing Yarn in as a resource manager. And Yarn stands for yet another resource manager. If you're not working in the Hadoop space and you think Hadoop is not your play, and we see that a lot, Hadoop plays a great role in organizations where a data lake comes something relative for you, and you care about bringing all of these silos together in one place. But what if you're a research institute and you don't have that data lake concept and you don't have that much of data? You can easily run on something like Mesos. And what Mesos is a standalone resource manager that you run Spark on it, and here you go, you've got a Spark cluster standalone working in. So if you're in genome sequencing, for example, you're doing variant calling, or if you're doing statistics on some certain research and in some sort of research facility, you can easily work on a siloed cluster. Or you can use the standalone scheduler on your laptop. And this is when people are just trying to utilize the memory on their laptop to do stuff. Can you do a big data set in there? Not really, but at least you can experience Spark on your laptop and see how it works. So Spark unifies all of these use cases here, the batch, the real-time, the stream, the machine, the interactive. And this is why Spark becomes a framework rather than a single tool that you're using for the right thing. Great. So why Spark and how Spark develops over the last couple of years? First of all, performance. Spark came with a completely new way of doing stuff. And when we were in the Hadoop world, we were trying to use the memory as much as we can, but Spark came in and said, I'm going to do everything in memory. And that changed the whole concept, especially in Hadoop when you're having clusters, let's say 100 node cluster, 64 gig of RAM in each node. This is a lot of aggregated memory that I can use. And this is where Spark can go in and use that unused memory in your cluster most of the time and can do a lot of stuff on. Developer productivity. One of the Spark main targets for 2015 was enriching the API contents for the third-party apps. So whether you're Power BI, whether you're using Tableau, whether you're using a lot of these Parquet data sets, any sort of APIs out there, and you want to connect it to it, you can have a JDBC driver, you can have an ODBC connectivity. So it makes it more publicly reachable, and you don't have to be a complete coder in order to get to use Spark. You can be a normal BI consultant, and you can use Spark in the same way you're working with any other database. Unified engine, and this is when we talked about how we're actually bringing the streaming part with the SQL part with everything together. But even as a SQL use case only, I go a lot to organizations where they say, oh, we have this massive data warehouse and we have Hadoop, but they have to live together all the time and we need to do a federated query. And this is a big topic that always shows up. And Spark can help you do that because you can connect Spark with a JDBC link to your data warehouse or a database and another JDBC link to Hive, for example, or to Hadoop or whatever, even any other single database. And you can bring the data together and do a single federated query, and guess what? It's all in memory. And that's the beauty of it. So we read the table, we put the table in memory, and we read everything out of memory, and we give the results out of memory as well. And the ecosystem, so you can only load stuff that are approved in the API and the third party, and there's a lot of them so far. So the most common thing that people use is something like HDFS. So if you have a file sitting in HDFS right now, and if you visit me in the stand later on with Microsoft, we're showing an unstructured data use case and how the files are ended up in HDFS and how Spark actually can do stuff with it as well. On an RDMS, so your data could live on a database, your data could live in S3, in Hive, Cassandra, or MongoDB, and all runs on top Apache Yarn, of course. And we can bring the data from all of them, put them in memory, and do whatever coordination between them. Great, so why a unified platform? Again, talking about the data lake concept, you have a data set. That data set is sitting somewhere. You have a BI team, you've got a data science team, you've got other kind of teams who need to access this data. You've got different skills in the organization. You have people with Java skills, people with Python skills, people with SQL skills. So how are we gonna access all the data from one place? This is where Spark comes in, because Spark gives you an ability to work any language into that data. So you can have a single data set, and you can have a line coming from Python and Scala and R and SQL, of course. So you don't have to copy and multiplex the data multiple times for different teams and different skill set to use that. So this is another very important part of it. Spark works with something called RDDs. So the RDDs is mainly the data set, the resilient distributed data set. So whenever we're reading a data set, Spark converts it into an RDD and puts it in memory. And this is how all the Spark component accesses the data set. So the use cases, a lot of people say, oh, so what is my use case for Spark and the analytics part of it? Whether we're talking about data integration and ETL. So you're ETLing the data somehow into the cluster. You could use Spark streaming for that. You can use just only Scoop for that if it's a batch loading into Hive, for example. A very important part, Spark SQL specifically was built on Hive. Spark SQL got 200,000 line of codes. Hive got 1.5 million line of code. So in order for them not to rewrite everything, they're just using the Hive query language, and they're adding the memory part of it on top of Hive. So therefore, there's a massive integration between Spark SQL and Hive. And if you have a Hive database, the meta store is actually shared between Spark SQL and Hive. So data integration and ETL, it comes the cleansing, the combining of the data, Spark Streaming can take care of that. Interactive analytics, this is when you're actually doing the SQL queries and you're doing data discovery, let's say, and you want to have a fast access to the data, and that happens in memory as well. High performance batch computation, because again, we run on top of Spark, we can, on top of Hive, we can allow Hive to do the batch processes as much as we can. The machine learning, with the machine learning pipelines, you can create a pipeline using Python, you can train your algorithm on it, you can even use R to do your machine learning. Real-time stream processing, of course, Spark Streaming would do that. At the time of you are streaming the data, we can add whatever we wanted to do, like an algorithm to check how many reservations coming from this airlines concerning these frequent flyers, for example, if we're talking about an airlines use case. Some of the use cases here, Netflix is one of the biggest users and contributors of Spark in the market. So the recommendation engine, every time you start typing a movie or something, how it predicts what's gonna happen is through Spark streaming. Webtrends, if you're familiar with Webtrends, go to YouTube, Google Webtrends, they do 10 million event message per second using Spark streaming as well. So we've been working with these guys for a very long time back in the US.
And just to add one there, we actually have a lot of users in Azure today who see Spark as being the transformation engine for the rest of the system. So they're actually pulling in all their data into a Spark data lake for a better word. And they're actually using that then to actually transform that data and then load that data at the final presentation point into the Azure SQL Data Warehouse or SQL DB. Yep. So at least that way you get the best of both worlds in terms of integration.
Great, thank you, Matthew. And furthermore, you gotta understand that people ask, where does Spark store data? Spark never stores data. Spark doesn't have a storage layer. Spark can write a data file somewhere, but you have to give them the stored layer. Spark doesn't store data by itself. So usually you will store data in HDFS. That's the most of the people had using Spark. You store data directly in HDFS. You can still just save data in a JSON file or a text file eventually or a CSV format. But we prefer, for example, something like an ORC file or a Parquet file in HDFS because its binary is compressed. And if you look at ORC files, this is something, again, we brought to the ecosystem recently. This is where we grab all the metadata and we put it in a header. So instead of having a file of 1 gigabyte, you end up with 60% compression on it, and you can some average count sort of queries, we're doing it from the metadata rather than doing a full scan for that HDFS file. As long as it's in ORC format, that Spark supports. great. So quick numbers, everybody like numbers and they want to see how does that compare to what the others are doing. So this is, for example, a test that's been done based on different data sizes. So we're talking about around 100 terabytes. And so that this is what Hadoop has done in 2013. And that was mainly MapReduce at that time. So you can see from 72 minutes on 100 terabyte down to 23 minutes on 100 terabyte, 234 minutes for 1 petabyte, which is like 10 times the size with what, probably five times less the time as well. And you can see this is the biggest part, the number of nodes. So 2,100 nodes just to do the 100 terabyte on a MapReduce, well, you can do that in 200 nodes in Spark. Again, with the cores, again, with how much would it cost you on a cloud platform. So definitely Spark is a great use case. Is it for everyone? Maybe. It would depend on the use case. The way I see it, I see Spark works the best when you're talking to, we have seen it in testing, anything below 1 petabyte, Spark does a great job in it. And as long as you have the right memory size, as long as you have the right config, that plays perfectly. Again, that's a logistic regression and how long does it take on a MapReduce or a Hadoop style versus Spark only. That's running time. How does it differ when you're reading and writing data with Spark, when you're reading and writing data with MapReduce? So traditionally with MapReduce, the most expensive operation that we have in a data center is reading an I/O from a disk, because this is where you have to go physically out of the server, down to the cable, down to the disk, spin the disk, get to the right sector, read the I/O, bring it back all the way. So in order to avoid this expensive operation, Spark reads data from memory, but not for the first time, because the first time your data is in disk anyway. So the first time I'll have to read it, whether I'm in MapReduce or a Spark, you're gonna do that from the disk anyway. So you gotta go through this expensive I/O the first time. And this is why I said the use cases might be different. Because if a use case does do some sort of a repetition on the same data set, this is where Spark can shine and shine even better. Because once the data is read from HDFS, it's cached in memory. So the second time you try to do anything, like we're talking about any streaming, any SQL, anything similar to the data set or part of it where it was cached before, we will read it the next time from memory. And that will be bang, sub-second, in milliseconds for sure. In traditional MapReduce, the problem was, even if we read from HDFS the first time, the second time, it doesn't matter, we'll have to go down through the whole way again, all the way to the disk, to the sector, to read the IO and bring it back. And the third time, and the fourth time, and this is where the time makes sense. So a lot of people say, oh, but I've just tried Spark now, and it gave me kind of like the same results, or a little bit faster, but not much. Yeah, because this is your first time reading from it. Now read, once you cache the data set, that's it. It's in memory, it's persisted in memory until the, what we call a Spark context got either killed or moved. So how does it work and distribute the data? So we have, once you start Spark, there's something called the Spark context that gets starts in the back. And the Spark context becomes like the cluster manager, let's say. And whenever you have a job for Spark to do, the first thing Spark does is allocate that task to different worker nodes. And the data, every worker node will read the first time the data from the disk, but the second time, every data set for every worker node will be cached in the local memory for every worker node. So a whole cluster of 1 petabyte of memory, you're gonna use the local memory for every node in there. And you've got the HDFS layer down there that we're reading and writing from, and it's distributed across the nodes. So that's the same thing when you're executing. It's kind of the same thing exactly. The cluster manager will send the command and all the worker nodes will execute. They'll bring back the results and bring it back to you. And which takes me to the next very important subject, how to work with Spark. Now, if you have ever downloaded Spark and work on it, you'll see a very boring black screen and you're gonna do a lot of commands on it. Now, we need to change that. And the best way to do that is through something called notebooks. Anybody heard of Zeppelin? 2, 3, great. So I'm a big fan of these guys. Zeppelin, I believe it's kind of like the next generation notebooks. IPython and Jupyter is still a very big leader in the market in the notebooks as well. They both work with Spark, and the way they work with Spark, they have Spark in the back as an interpreter. And the beauty of both of them that if you're a SQL guy, or a Python guy, or a Scala guy, or a Java guy, or whatever, you can all work together on that beautiful same notebook, doing the commands that you want on it. And you don't have to have these different tools all over the place to do stuff. So it is web-based. I'm gonna show you a quick demo, mainly on Zeppelin. We'll see Zeppelin later on becoming the front end for anything Hadoopy stuff. So you're trying to upload files, download files, you're trying to do any sort of commands in any language, you just do it from there, and you can use any sort of interpreters, and one of them could be Spark. So rather than going through this, let me quickly take you hands-on with Apache Zeppelin and see how it works. So let's hit the right button here. So while I'm here, I'll be going back to the slides as well. For the people who doesn't know what that is, this is Apache Ambari. Apache Ambari is our way, is how HORDA works and HD Insight works. So what the first thing you get to see is Apache Ambari. Apache Ambari is mainly components, as you can see here in the left part. Because we're completely open source, you can have your own component in there. Any third-party plugin, they have something in there. And if you look here at the left, you'll see the bottom down one here is Zeppelin Notebook. So that means you don't have to download Zeppelin and install it as a service by itself and run it on a different VM with a server. You can just include it here, and Spark as well. And for Spark, we always run the latest version minus one. Why minus one? Because the latest version is usually not always stable, so we run with a most stable version, which is one version behind. So 1.5 is out there now. We do what we call a tech preview on 1.5. That means you can download it, but we're not going to support you if something goes wrong because of the code and not because of how we support you. But there's nothing stopping you from downloading whatever Spark version and put it here. So whenever it's here, that means we're managing that for you. You can check out the UI here. You can have these performance gadgets. You can see all of the things around. Now, this is if you're an administrator, you would love to look at this all day and see how things are going and check out the different jobs. You can check Spark in here. You can even go, without going to the XML files, you can just go here. This is the XML files. And every time you do any change, you'll see a new version coming up automatically. So that means at least it's tracking every change in the configs that you're doing. So what people does in the configs most of the time is the memory part and the number of cores. And this is important. I have a cluster. I have a 1 petabyte memory total cluster. I want to make sure that my BI team got their own SLAs and they can run reports on time. And I don't want Spark people to come in and load a big data set and eats up all my memory. So this is when we do the separation between the BI and data science. We give the Spark people a specific amount of dedicated memory for them. And we give, for example, the Hive people special memory and number of cores for them to run on to make sure that nobody's gonna overlap on the other or take any sort of memory from the other when needed. Now, a great thing that we brought again to Unbody was something called Unbody Views. That will lead me to Zeppelin, by the way. I'm still within the same context. So if you look at Unbody Views is the way for you as an end user to interact with what we're doing. So as an administrator, the left part makes a lot of sense. But if you're a user, we actually lock you down and you don't see any of that, and you only see this screen. And this screen is what we call views. The first thing that you want to do most of the time is upload a data set, upload a file or download a file. So you'll go, for example, to HDFS file, and you'll go to the folder that you have and you've got permission on, and you'll upload a file in there. And you just choose whatever file you want to upload. Bang, done. It's happening. So of course, everything is still secured with what we call Ranger. Security is completely another aspect of that that we're not going to be able to cover this time. But as I was saying, HDFS is part of it. If you want to write queries directly, you can just go into Hive and write queries from here. Now, to Spark part, let's have a look at Zeppelin. So this is the first thing you see when you log into Zeppelin. A very nice welcome page with the notebooks that are created already. I'm going to take you through a couple of them just to show you what Zeppelin can do and what it can't do. Before you start creating any nodes, the first thing you want to look at is what we call an interpreter. The interpreter in the back is what Zeppelin is using in the back. So in the Spark days, pure Spark, you'll create what we call a Spark contest. And make it run in the background. What Zeppelin does it for you, so you don't have to do that manually. So what you go to Zeppelin, and you tell Zeppelin how much memory you're allowed to use from Spark, because you might have a Java app that is talking to Spark, and you don't want the memory to overlap between the people who are using Zeppelin on Spark and the people who are using the Java on Spark. You'll tell Zeppelin where is Spark installed, and the HDFS jar that it's going to be using, and that would depend on the version of Hadoop that you're running. And this is important, the one on the top. So percentage Spark, this is the default. Whenever you're running anything, that means you're running in Scala, because Spark was written on Scala. Scala is the default language for Spark. If you start with percentage PySpark, you're telling the notebook that I'm going to start now writing Python. So it will immediately understand that you're about to write Python, and every time you write on Python, it will just interpret it using what we call PySpark, Python Spark. That's another package for Spark built in. My favorite, for example, is the percentage SQL. This is when you're doing SQL discovery. You want to write a total SQL statement, and we're going to show you how to do it. If you want to add a dependency for your Scala or Java or Python programming, you want to add your own package, you can add a dependency. It's like importing a package in Java, for example. Now, does it do anything but other than Spark? Yes, it almost does everything. So you can do a lot of stuff right now. including Hive, for example, Tajo, Flink, Lens, Ignite, like there's Cassandra, like a zillion other stuff, Postgres, SQL, Kylin, there's a lot of other stuff. Now let's have a look at on what are the notebooks. I'll start with an easier notebook, so that's a Spark SQL example. This is an Australian data set that I grabbed from data.gov.au. I'm not going to bore you with the first part because that was mainly just downloading the data and pushing it into HDFS. But let's have a look at the things that we can look at here. So I'm not sure if you can read that, but what I'm doing here, I'm grabbing a CSV file and I'm just doing a count, and all of that is Scala. So I'm just trying to show to the Scala people that you can easily write Scala language in here. We work with something called DataFrame that we're going to get into a little bit. What I'm trying to show that we're grabbing a CSV file. The CSV file is how much the Australian government pays for healthcare expenditure around the country every year. So they have it on data.gov.au. It's on a big CSV file. Downloaded the file and we try to convert it. We're telling Spark that this CSV file consists of these columns over here, and I'm just defining the type of every column. So I'm kind of been a little bit lazy, so I've done everything as a string. It's usually you'll put it as a date and stuff like that, but just to show you what I'm doing here. And you create something called the table. So when you create a table, and this is when we said there's no stored layer because the table is not written anywhere. You're registering the table, so every time you're reading from that table, the table is in memory. So that CSV file goes to memory and you start reading the data directly from memory. So what I'm doing here, once I have what I call the health table here, which as you can see, it's uncommented here, health.register timetable health table, that means I have now a table called health table and I can do any SQL query on it. So let's have a look on my first SQL query on that notebook. I'll zoom that a little bit. So that was a normal SQL statement. The state sum by thousands, spending on billions, group it by state, and this is what we get. Now, this is a cool visualization part that you get out of Zeppelin. You can get it tabular as you know usually would do. You can just change it to any way of visualization that you want. The same thing, like it keeps going on and on with the different kind of things that you're trying to show. And the beautiful thing, once you create a story out of notebook, especially with the data and how the data is generated, you can convert that into a report. So you can go all the way up and you can say, okay, I don't want to show it as a notebook anymore. I want to show it as a report. And that becomes a report that you can just print out and send it to somebody. You can export it into HTML as well. So there's a lot of cool things that you can do out of it. A little bit more advanced, especially in the machine learning part, if we look at, that was developed out of one of my colleagues in the US, and that was just data discovering the earthquakes around the world and where we tend to see most of the earthquake and that sort of stuff. So if we look here, this is showing mainly the average depth of the earthquake. Down here, it shows what is the average magnitude, earthquake magnitude that we get most of the time. It shows 5 and 6 are the most. And finally, it plots this data on a table, on the map, showing you the most regions that are threatened by earthquakes most of the time. So it's pretty cool, very powerful tool. Using everything behind it is done in memory, very fast. There's no reason why we're not using it. And a new thing came out of Zeppelin, they call it Hub, and Hub allows you to integrate with Active Directory and LDAP, and it allows you to collaborate between the users internally. If user X and user Y are working on two different notebooks, you can actually see what everyone is doing and collaborate, especially when we're talking about big organizations, when we have a BI team, a marketing team, a data science team, and they all isolated in different pockets of that organization, and they can learn from each other, and they can see what every other is doing, so they can do a better stuff eventually. So that was mainly Zeppelin here. I'm going to flick back to the notes that we have. So you've seen Zeppelin. We've seen a little bit of Scala, Spark SQL, Shell. That's Jupyter. So probably if you've seen IPython or Jupyter, it's a pretty similar story, except that Zeppelin got kind of like a little bit more cool stuff. But if you're a big fan of Zeppelin, of IPython and Jupyter, you can still do the same thing exactly. R on Zeppelin is not out there yet. It's there. You can pre-compile it and put it there yourself, but it's not 100% supported. Where IPython and Jupyter supports R better way. So if you're an R guy, you would look more here, or even better, go to RevR.
You'll also find that the Jupyter notebooks. So when you actually create an instance of Spark on HT Insight, you'll find access to both of these notebooks, so you can decide which one you want to use. Just try them out. But you'll also see that Jupyter is also available as a notebook for Azure ML. So if you wanted to just develop, and this is in public preview today, you just want to develop on Revolution R, and then have that submitted to Azure ML as a service, then you can use the Jupyter notebooks for that.
Great, thanks. Spark streaming, I'm not going to take a lot of time in here. But mainly, the most important thing people ask us, why Spark streaming? Why not Storm? Why not just Kafka by itself? Why not just any other ingestion engine, Spring XD? The main difference, Spark streaming is microbatch. So what does microbatch mean? It means think about events happening right now and coming. These events are not going to be there. Like, they're going to be there in real time, but Spark is going to wait until I have a collection of event and push it. But it's a small collection. That's why it's microbatch. It's not fully batch. So something like Storm would do every event that comes in. It will be pushed right away. Again, what is the use case? There's not no one tool good for everything. Is my use case care about a millisecond difference or not? That sort of stuff. Sensor data, for example, we prefer something like Storm or either Apache NiFi. Again, passed by the stand. I'm showing a lot of cool stuff around that sort of things. But Spark streaming is grabbing a lot of attention because you can do the real-time analytics part of it is beautiful because you can just, once you have your algorithm built on Spark, you can add it in the Spark streaming context. So the data are flying in. While the data are flying in, you're doing something computational and you're coming out with the results that you can action something else that Spark could do, like a SQL insert in a table or a Zeppelin graphics being updated. If you heard of Zoom Data, it's kind of like an active reporting engine that connects to Spark as well, so you can have like a nice dashboard. I've got a couple of dashboards that you can visit as well. I can show you a quick look. So Spark, a lot of people use Spark streaming, whether you're doing PCAP capturing, packet capturing for network monitoring, you're connecting all your logs somewhere, intelligence, surveillance, fraud, e-commerce. So everything that has sort of data that could be streamed, you can definitely use Spark streaming for that. Spark streaming integrates with a message queue. The biggest changes in Spark streaming in 1.5, for example, that Spark never had what we call a back pressure. That means if you started loading a lot of data in the back of Spark streaming, you start like losing stuff because you're not able to push the data as they're coming as soon as possible. And therefore, the only way to control that is using something like Kafka, for example, where Kafka becomes the message queue. We bring all the events. We make sure that Kafka is having all the events in memory first, and then Kafka is pushing the right amount of data to Spark Streaming in order for Spark Streaming to process it. A cool thing happened in 1.5, Spark Streaming introduced what we call a back pressure. That means Spark Streaming nodes can have their memory part could save that data rather than losing that data. Right now, we still prefer using it with Kafka. Spark got something called a direct API with Kafka that we work with, and you can choose whatever that data will be ended up, whether it's HDFS, database, dashboard, or even a lookup. Spark streaming works with something called a DStream, so every micro batch message that passed by microbatch, set that passed by, we call it a D-stream, and this is how it passes by. Any question on Spark streaming specifically? Because all good. Spark SQL.
So this one over here.
Yep. Say that again, can you stream?
Can you query the stream without actually storing it?
Good question. We get that a lot. So a lot of people say, can I do a lookup on a stream before it actually gets stored? You can. The event depends on the event and how you're doing the event. So you could you could put that logic into Spark streaming itself, that based on the data that is coming, if it's this, do that. What people tend to do, they would have something called a lookup database in memory. That could be something like Redis, for example, that they put it next to Spark Streaming. And every 5 minutes, so the lookup in memory will be a 5 minute threshold. And after the, once the 5 minutes like is, are over, we flush the data down, and you could put that rule in the flushing down. So say, okay, only that sort of data I want to do flush down, otherwise I don't need it anymore.
Another option in the Azure ecosystem is to front the Spark streaming with event hubs, and then you can actually achieve that via that.
So you can filter that as well from there, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. So the SQL part is kind of like the what a lot of people ask about all the time, because there's a lot of SQL engineers and a lot of companies, and they're seeing how can they expand the knowledge on new stuff. Now, the cool thing and the good news that you can currently do all of that, that means, and the biggest one is JDBC. So as long as your database got a JDBC, you can connect to it right now, and you can grab data out of it, put it in memory, and do cool stuff. If you come to the meetups, you'll see every new meetup, we're doing a cool new thing. So in one of the meetups, we had databases. We had a SQL Server, MySQL, and different databases running, and we showed how we're bringing a table from every one of those and putting all of them in memory and do one query to query different data sets from different databases at the same time. a JSON format text file. Now, this is when we're talking about the semi-structured and the unstructured world, and that sort of data doesn't fit usually in a normal database. You either need a proper value store for it, we use something like HBase for that, or if you just want to put it on this kind of like the same format, but in the HDFS file, and what we do, we create something called an external table out of it because it's sitting just on a file. And Spark could read that as well and read from it. Hive, of course, as long as your data sitting with Hive, Spark could read from it. And mainly, again, this is because Spark doesn't have a stored layer. It relies on these people, these guys, to be the stored layer for Spark, because it doesn't read blocks or write blocks anywhere. So this is built in. The external comes from the every other company, like Elastic, for example. They have their own. Cassandra, they have their own. And there you go.
And just to add an Azure twist to this, from the built-ins, fully supports the Azure Storage Blobs as well as the S3, and on the external, you can output read. You can read from SQL Server, SQL Data Warehouse. You can write out to them as well.
Great, and a Blob Store, right?
Blob Store.
Awesome. So that's the mainly. It's almost an ANSI SQL. It derives everything from the Hive query language. So if you're trying to find a certain syntax for something and it didn't work on the normal syntax, just look for the Hive syntax, and that would be the same as the Spark, because, as I said, it's all built on Hive from a SQL context. if you're an app developer or you're not using Notebook, because Zeppelin would do something like that for you, this is how you initiate Spark and you start it. You create a variable, could be we call it an SE, and then a SQL context, and you initialize it. In the later versions, you don't have to do that anymore. Once you start it, it starts up automatically. But this is the SQL context is where all your data that are across the cluster are sharing the same SQL context. So if you have multiple SQL contexts, every SQL context will read their data only. They cannot read the other SQL context data. So that's why we'll kind of limit one SQL context per cluster if you want the different apps and different data to read from the same context. A data frame that is a little bit advanced, but a data frame is something that Spark came in 1.3, and that solved a massive problem because Spark was built on Scala, so everything Scala was super fast, everything with Python was very slow, everything SQL was very slow. So the way Spark solved that was bringing something called a data frame. If you know Python or R, you probably know what a data frame is already. But if you don't, think about a data frame as a table. It's just bringing any sort of structured or semi-structured data and it putting it into a table format and it's reading back from it. From our perspective, the only thing that we do is just we convert whatever data we bring to a data frame, and that happens, again, depending on what you're trying to do and where you're trying to do it. So that becomes a pretty tabular format, easier to read, columnar, because most of the time you're trying to read certain columns, you're not trying to read everything at once. Again, more code on how to create the data frames. If you're code savvy, you'll understand that immediately. So what we're doing here, we're creating a value called df, and we're bringing a JSON file that is sitting somewhere. And as I said, that could be an HDFS file, that could be a file that my Spark streaming dropped in my HDFS right now, and I'm gonna go back and read it. Or you can read it from a Hive table. So you already have the Hive table from the batch that happened overnight from a SQL server, and you want to read it. You have a Parquet file. We always talk again, Parquet, Orc, Avro. These are the three different binary files that sits on Hadoop, because the last thing you want is just to put a clear text file in there, not optimized, not fast, not compressed. To be fully supported with Hortonworks and to have the best support out of it, we usually recommend Orc files. And if you just want to connect to a JDBC, to a database, you just load a JDBC, the URL depends on the database string connection that you should have. So pretty simple, we're loading from four different sources, no hassle, one line, and that's it. So even if you don't have Scala knowledge, it doesn't matter. Even if you're only a SQL person, this is not a showstopper, because this is the only line that you'll be writing in. And you can copy it and paste it, and once you have it, like, this is the only line that you need to know, and the rest can actually happen through SQL. So you only need to know how you can connect to the database or how to connect to the table you want. So copy paste that line, change, just get the right string connection, and you're good. So again, more on the data frames and comparing to the RDDs. Spark would suggest or probably recommend that you run everything on a data frame whenever possible, rather than a clear RDD as we used to do in the past, mainly because the data frames are much faster. This is more on how does it happen. So you get a JSON file, you convert it to a data frame, then we registered it as a table. Until now, we didn't. So this is my source, and I haven't written anything here yet. And everything here is just presentation. So this is when we say, again, why we don't have a stored layer, because we're writing here and we're showing you the data here. You can save the results manually. There's a command called df.save to CSV file or a JSON file or whatever file that you want. Again, that's simple code just to show it. It's actually three lines. It looks more, but it's mainly three lines. You're loading a JSON file. You're registering the JSON file as a table. So we're converting a semi-structured file into a database file or a table file. And I'm doing a select. And I'm doing a select from Scala, not from SQL. You could do a SQL directly. You can just write this directly if you're using the Spark SQL context mainly.
So I'm thinking that because of the time, did you want to move to your demo?
So we kind of showed the demo.
You said you had a machine learning demo.
So that's the earthquake ones.
Oh, okay.
The earthquake ones. So the last bit was the machine learning part here. And it's mainly what you can do with Spark. So ML Spark is an important factor because on top of everything we talked about, you can build the algorithms to run on Spark, and they could be part of Spark streaming if you're doing interactive analytics or real-time analytics. Or you could do that as a job that happens later on. So whether we're talking about supervised algorithms, unsupervised, or just recommendation engines, A lot of things that are not supported yet that are getting supported every day. We always say Spark is getting there. It's not right there at the top yet when it comes to the algorithms that it does support. So K-means, for example, was introduced recently in 1.4. So that was like less than 6 months ago. And of course, all the linear models are already supported. This is a use case on a data set based on the movies user rating. I'm not going to go deep in that, but it's just mainly showing you how we're building an algorithm, kind of like a recommendation engine based on the user rating for specific movies.
So it follows the same kind of principles as like Azure Machine Learning. You have to train the model first before you can then make use of that. And you see on the next slide, we got an example there of actually how you actually train the model within Spark, that specific movie recommendations. Now it's pretty straightforward code. There's what?
Yep.
6-7 lines of code there. Really, there's a lot of comments.
And you can see the main model training line is just one line. All these lines were just reading the data, splitting the data, and making sure that the data falls under the right format. And again, we're choosing what rating it is based on the file that we have, because the file was mainly rating. So saying, okay, we have the user that we want to convert it to integer movie, and the rating is double. And then we're training the model based on that with the Spark machine learning. So that takes a lot of code out of your sheet if you need to do algorithm training.
So one of the big benefits of using Spark for doing the machine learning is if you've got a lot of data that you want to process, then this is actually going to be a better place to actually do that processing than, say, something like Azure ML, even if it doesn't have the same set of algorithms that Azure ML does today. You should at least take a look at this, because performance-wise, this will be a lot faster for that process.
Great. I guess I've reached to the last. It's mainly about that. Matthew, do you want to add if these slides will be available publicly so people
yes.
can?
Yeah, so everything here, one of the reasons why there's a lot of code there is so that you can actually just cut and paste it from the slides and try it out yourself.
Great. And I've shown the Zeppelin demo already using Spark, and I've showed you the two different data sets. I have a lot of data sets that we show all the time. There was an interesting one that we showed in the meetup last time. That was the taxation data, the tax data from the ATO. That was pretty impressive, showing you which sectors make the most of the money, and that was pretty cool. So you know when you want to leave IT, what job to have next. great. Before we end up, any question on Spark in general? I'm happy to have a Hadoop question if you have, or HD Insight question. Matthew can answer.
So just to repeat that, there's going to be an event between Microsoft and Hortonworks in Melbourne, Sydney, and Brisbane
early December.
Revolution team will be available as well as part of that.
Great. So that invites will be sent out to people, right?
Yeah, I'll just scan you. I have a scanner with me. Or you can come by the Siegel booth down on the showcase area.
Great. Great. Yeah, that's a big question. A lot of people ask it. So R is supported on Spark. You can run R on Spark starting 1.4. But there's a lot of algorithms that are not yet supported. So this is where if you're running production stuff right now with R and you require fully blown R functionality, RevR is the way to go. I don't think there's, especially if you're talking about productionizing it and clustering and running the whole thing. Spark is not there yet with the R.
Just to add that, so 1.4 is actually not available yet on the Azure version of Spark. So that's coming soon. So we're currently at 1.2.1.
Great. So yeah, that's the main difference. So people would still probably choose RevR when they need a fully blown capability of R. They can get part of it in Spark right now, but not the full thing.
If you think about it from the Microsoft kind of Azure ecosystem, there's now what, at least 6-7 different places where you can actually do machine learning, or at least moving forward. So Azure ML being one of them. You've got the Jupyter Notebooks that's now attached with it, where you can actually do pure R code. You've got you could spin up a Revolution R Enterprise Edition VM within Azure, so it's actually in the marketplace if you want to try it out. It's available there. You've got the full the graphical interface as well to actually make use of if you use the Windows version, not the Linux version. And on top of that, there's the Azure Data Lake Store. Azure Data Lake Analytics, which contains the ability to embed machine learning code as well, but that's from a .NET angle. So if you've got any .NET machine learning algorithms you want to make use of, then the Data Lake Analytics can use them. Obviously, Spark ML, SQL Server, obviously is now with 2016 going to be embedding the Revolution R capabilities. In the future, you'll have that within SQL DB and SQL Data Warehouse as well. So there's lots of different places you can actually make use of machine learning now, because we see that as being probably the top question that customers ask, where to do their predictive analytics, and pretty much the answer is everywhere.
Yeah. Great. Thank you for the question. Any other questions?
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.